You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Time.
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 There are several different realities that coexist simultaneously.
Time is the fire in which we burn.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, DJs in Texas who slow their music to a crawl.
Everything is just slow motion. It's like you're not in the real world.
And a photographer and an essayist pick apart a modern ruin in downtown Detroit.
Nobody's interested in buildings here until they're decayed. Then you create your own stories and your own myths about it.
My guest is the writer and physicist Alan Lightman. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. A couple of weeks ago, I told you about a remarkable day I had walking around New York City, when I kept running into accidental and ad hoc art where I least expected it. Last weekend, my serendipitous connect-the-dots experience of art and ideas all took place indoors, sitting down, as I listened to a new record and read a new book and went to see a new film. On Saturday morning, I put on a CD of medieval chants I'd cadged from the piles of free records that collect in our office. The record was La Belle Marie, Songs to the Virgin from 13th century France, sung by a New York group called Anonymous Four. So I settled down into my couch and opened up a new book that seemed as distant as could be from the music I was hearing. The book is called The Conversations and consists of conversations between the novelist Michael Ondaatje and the motion picture editor Walter Murch. Murch is one of the great Hollywood editors. He cut all three Godfathers, Apocalypse Now, and The English Patient, among many other films. And it turns out he has a wildly expansive, deeply interesting intellect. In The Conversations, he suggests that the art of movies, barely 100 years old, is where music was back in the early Middle Ages, back before the notes and bars and keys of musical notation had been developed. As he says, it was musical notation that permitted polyphony, multiple musical lines and instruments playing together. And so it was musical notation that permitted all the musical complexity that followed. In other words, all of what we know as classical music. I looked up. I listened more carefully. Music from the 13th century, songs from the very beginning of musical notation. Beautiful, sublime, but not a bit of polyphony. Immediately, I got what Murch was talking about. Citizen Kane and Goodfellas, as splendid as they are, may be to movies, future movies, as medieval chants are to Mozart and Stravinsky. At 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning, half awake, I found that to be a mind-blowing notion. On Sunday, I flipped through my weekly copy of the Los Angeles Times Book Review and found a review of the book by the movie director John Borman. His only complaint is that Murch, quote, fails to acknowledge that the underlying power of the movies is that they so closely approximate the condition of dreaming. That Sunday evening, as it happened, I went with my family to see Spirited Away, the new animated film by the Japanese director Hayao Miyazaki.
Mommy!
Spirited Away is about a girl trying to rescue her parents who have been turned into pigs, but no plot description can begin to do the film justice. All I know is it's an astounding, beautiful, fabulous movie that more satisfyingly approximates the condition of dreaming than almost any film I've ever seen. I don't think it's a stretch to compare it as a work of art to Alice in Wonderland or even A Midsummer Night's Dream. That night in bed, I returned to the LA Times Book Review, and there, before I turned off the light, I happened to see a quote from Franz Kafka. A work of art, Kafka said, must be an ice axe to break the frozen sea within us. Last weekend, I felt that a few small holes had been chopped in my frozen sea. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I know a lot of you have had days and moments like this, where it feels as if, in your small corner of the world, civilization is alive with good vibrations. We'd like to hear about these stories and talk about some of them on the air. Please let us know. Click on the How Art and My Real Life Collide link on our website, studio360.org. Today on Design for the Real World, we take a closer listen to something you hear every day. Multimedia artist and designer Ben Rubin explains the origin of the telephone ring.
The very first telephones, meaning, you know, back in the days of Watson, come here, I need you, had no ringers at all. And they also hadn't invented the switch hook, so phones were never hung up. They were always connected. So I would just yell into my phone, "Hello!" And if you were nearby, you might hear that. And that didn't really work very well. So people discovered that it worked a little better to actually tap on the mouthpiece. And that didn't work very well either. So Watson actually invented this little thing called the thumper, which was a button that you would push on the phone that would cause a little hammer inside the phone to move and actually tap the pickup of the microphone. So that was, in a sense, the first kind of telephone ringer. And eventually that got replaced by what you might have seen in movies, you know, where you see someone cranking a phone. So this was still in the days when phones were on sort of closed circuit lines, only your phone would only be connected to one or maybe a handful of other phones. And so when you turn your crank, you can actually express yourself in some way through the phone ringing mechanism. If you're really frantic and urgent, you crank the thing a lot and that message will kind of get through, like there's an urgent call. As the switching system came into place, you had more and more of a separation between you and the person that you're calling, and eventually, you know, that function of ringing is taken over by a machine that generates the kind of ring cycle that we're familiar with. Essentially, the telephone ring, as it came into being in the 20s and 30s, stayed almost entirely unchanged until approximately the 80s, late 70s, 80s. The sound that's come to replace that beautiful, familiar telephone ring is this. And to me, this is it's a really poor substitute. You know, it's cheaper to make phones that just have a plastic little ringing component that's electronic instead of a pair of brass bells. This is what's happening right now. The sound that you choose for your cell phone becomes almost like, it's like a personal audible logo for yourself. It's kind of a fashion accessory. The sound is me. This is, you know, this is the sound that I choose to emanate when my phone rings. It starts to go back to the days when you could hand crank the phone ringer, in that a phone ring, again, is starting to express something. It's not just this generic sound that's been chosen for you by the telephone company. It actually can carry something of you in it.
Ben Rubin is a multimedia artist and designer. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story.
They say time is the fire in which we burn.
That is some quality melodrama from Star Trek Generations.
Right now, Captain, my time is running out.
We're talking today about time and all the ways we think about it and play with it. Think of Gabriel Garcia Marquez expanding his characters' lives across centuries. or Proust lingering for chapters over one single sun-drenched moment, or Madonna's biannual reinvention. My guest today is the astrophysicist and novelist Alan Lightman. His hugely popular and remarkable book, Einstein's Dreams, is a series of meditations on the nature of time. Alan, your new novel, The Diagnosis, also connects to the idea of time. It is, in large measure, about the price we pay for our modern obsession with speed, among other things. Why does this idea appeal to you? Why does this idea something you had to write about?
Well, I don't know why I'm particularly obsessed with time, but I did write about the frenzy of modern life in my latest novel because I feel that is a malaise of our society. I think that the frantic speed has deprived us of slowness and silences and privacy. So I think that we've paid a lot for that speed.
You have, as nearly as I can tell, for your whole life been simultaneously an artist and a scientist, a kid who played with rockets and a kid who wrote poems. A few years ago, you moved from the physics department at MIT to its humanities department. Was that part of this same dawning sense you had that art was where you were happier?
Well, that decision was actually a practical decision because I was a theoretical physicist, and theoretical physicists, and to a lesser extent, all scientists reach their peak at a fairly young age. There's a certain mental agility, almost an athleticism involved with scientific work, and it favors a young age. And once I had passed that age, I had always been interested in the arts and in writing. Once I had passed that peak and I was aware of it when it happened, I could see my powers decreasing. I decided that I would put more of my life's effort into writing fiction in which I hope that I can grow and get better and better for many years. So it was a practical decision to move more from physics to the humanities.
In Einstein's Dreams, you meditate at various moments on the different ways that time can be said to exist, that it may be a circle that bends back on itself and repeats endlessly, or that it may be a stream that can be displaced and rippled by breezes, and so on. Do you have the conviction or the belief or the sense that, in fact, time is a human invention, that we've imposed our notion of time on existence?
Well, I think that there's a physical time and there's a psychological time. And the physical time, I think, is something that does exist outside of our bodies. It is described quantitatively by Einstein's theory of special relativity. And I think that more or less all scientists accept that theory as describing the flow of physical time. But an equally interesting and an equally strange form of time is psychological time, the human experience of time. And that, I believe, is a very rich construction of the human mind. That responds to our emotions and our feelings. And that, to me, is wonderful territory for a writer, as you mentioned, Marcel Proust and Gabriel Garcia Marquez and many other writers have played with the sort of psychological and human experience of time.
Which is the form of time that you, in The Diagnosis, worry about being sort of altered in a way that we're not entirely in control of.
Yes, yes.
Your wife is a painter?
She is.
Do you have a sense that she looks at time differently than you as a result of that discipline?
I think she looks at time differently than me because she's a different kind of a person. She's a person who is able to live in the moment. And I think if there's any quality in my book, Einstein's Dreams, that I treasure most, it's the worlds where a person is able to live in the moment. I think that is a precious gift. And my wife has that gift. She is able to suspend time and just live in whatever activity she's doing it with no thought for the past and no thought for the future. And of course, when she paints, she gets into this creative state, which all artistic people do, where time is suspended. But I think that this aspect of her personality is even stronger, whereas I am more of a type A person who is constantly thinking about what am I going to do next, the future. I'm very much thinking about the future, and consequently, I don't live well in the moment, and I think that this is a great loss, which I regret.
Is there an aspect of time and its perception that you find especially interesting?
I find it fascinating that sometimes time seems to move slowly and sometimes it moves quickly. I know that when I go into my creative state, when I'm writing, that 4 or 5 hours can go by and I'm totally unaware of it. Whereas when I'm experiencing some intense pleasure or some intense pain, then I'm aware of each millisecond. And I think this is a marvelous and strange quality of human consciousness, that the mind time or the body time does not flow at a constant rate.
And I suppose before Einstein figured out how time worked, and we all were convinced of that, or the scientists were convinced and we believed them, that there was no disjuncture between that mutable, slowing, accelerating perception of time and the sense of what time itself was.
Body time, or this mutable time that we were talking about, was always with us from primitive times. We of course, knew that there were regular temporal clocks in nature, like day and night and the seasons. But I believe that when the first clock, good clock, was invented, and it was probably a water clock, and people could see the dropping of time in drops of water or in drops of sand, time flowing outside of their own bodies. This must have been the great shock in history regarding time.
I think you're right, and it's interesting, isn't it, and not coincidental, that the invention of clocks, the invention of capitalism, and the Enlightenment project generally sort of happened at the same moment. And what you're talking about now at this exponentially accelerated end of that is simply all of those good things that began in the Renaissance carried on and on.
Just a continuation. Yes, too much of a good thing.
I'm Kurt Anderson talking today with the physicist and writer Alan Lightman. In a minute, we'll introduce you to a sluggish music revolution in Texas. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest today is the novelist and scientist Alan Lightman. We're talking about time. Sometimes just a little shift in how we use time can make a huge difference. That's definitely true with the music of a DJ in Houston. The performer DJ Screw took popular hip-hop mixes and slowed them down to half their playing speed. The resulting sound put a spell on Texas and sold hundreds of thousands of tapes. Michael May explains that in Houston, hip-hop artists are getting rich, releasing each of their albums in two different versions, regular and screwed.
If you're not from Texas, you're probably thinking, that sounds screwed up. Relax. You're right. It is screwed up, thanks to Houston's DJ Screw. It may sound on the first listen like the soundtrack to a fever dream, but to thousands of screwheads, it's a tonic for the mind.
It puts us in a zone of relaxation. I mean, you could be stressed out, but the minute you put a screw tape in, you'll sit back and that screw tape will clear your mind. in no time, basically. Everything is just slow motion. It's like you're not in a real world. When you listen to a song at regular speed now, it's like a chipmunk. Cause I'm just so used to listening to everything slow.
Even though the portly baby-faced DJ Screw never even saw his 30th birthday, his creation, Screw Music, is bigger than ever. But not everyone thinks that's a good thing. In the wake of his death, the Medium police were quick to equate Screw Music with what dragged his heart to a stop, codeine. As the slowed-down sound spread across Texas, so did the use of his favorite cocktail, cough syrup and soda water. It's a concoction known as lean because it, well, kind of makes you lean over. I smoke sweet after sweet cause I can't do without it. Lean hard on the drink till I start to dream about it. Wake up a new day, puffin' dank. Mix another drink, my... But to reduce DJ Screw's music to nothing but a gateway to drugs ignores his incredible impact on Southern hip-hop. DJ Screw grew up in the central Texas town of Smithville and was inspired to become a DJ at 13 years old after he saw the movie Breakin'. Mama Screw, whose real name is Ida Davis, said she didn't exactly encourage his earlier efforts.
I told the boy, I said, I'm gonna come home and I'm gonna catch you messing with my records no more. So by the time he think I get off work, he put them all back in place. But I caught him one day. I sneaked up on him. He had my records, and he was in there. Screwed up all my records.
In 1989, DJ Screw was living in Houston with his father, working as a DJ at a roller rink. One day while making a mixtape, he turned the pitch knob way, way down and brought Smithville's lazy pace to Houston. The warped hypnotic sound he created would forever alter the sound of Texas hip-hop. Mama Screw.
He was so slow. He moved slow. He walked slow. So what did you expect? He slowed everything down. He slowed down Texas. But that was just my sound.
Mama Screw had always made a little extra money selling homemade blues tapes, but her son made it a career. He started selling Screw tapes from his house, and his friends sold them across Texas. The rapper Shorty Mack, a childhood friend, was in Austin at the time.
In Austin, people get in the car with me, and we'd be driving down the road, and I see them just rush to the deck and eject the tape and pull it out and start hitting. What are you doing? Man, the tape is getting caught up. Man, that's the way the tape go. I grab the tape for them and put it back in the deck. Then we probably smoke a joint or something. They start getting high. And by the time we get to the second side of the tape, they done start moving a little bit. Oh, you starting to like that, huh? Yeah, it's all right, it's all right. Yeah, you damn near tore my tape up. Now you jamming into it. And they'll start laughing. But in time, man.
In time, the sluggish groove was pouring out of car stereos across the state. Mac quit selling crack and moved to Screw tapes. It was safer and paid just as well. DJ Screw himself was making thousands a week without ever dealing with record companies, or for that matter, even leaving his house. After repeated hassles with the police, who were sure DJ Screw was selling drugs, he opened a storefront shop called Screwed Up Records and Tapes. DJ Screw never played by the rules, but he controlled the hip-hop market in Houston. If he put a song on a tape, you were sure to hear it on the radio. And most of the biggest hip-hop stars in Texas got their start improvising on Screw tapes. Shorty Mac.
The first Screw tape I ever done, I was so nervous. This is like coming out with a debut album or something.
Disappear from the scene, trying to change from cooking cream, but when figures don't add up, it's to the stream. By all means, to feed my seeds, cooking cut, hover the scene till it's empty. Moving swiftly, lost, can't give me look how they game trying to tip.
DJ Screw aimed to spread a message of self-determination in his mixtapes. Many are like hip-hop morality plays, with the songs arranged around a common theme and cautionary verses repeated over and over for effect.
Things just ain't the same for gangsters. Cops are anxious to put niggas in handcuffs. They wanna hang us, see us dead or enslave us. Keep us trapped in the same place we raised in. Then they wonder why we act so outrageous. Run around stretched out and pull out gauges. Things just ain't the same for gangsters. Cops are anxious to put...
Most time when you listen to what he's repeating and chopping up, it's positive words. It's, you know, it's not about gangbang. It's about making money, honest money, getting people off the streets and doing things with your life.
That was John Atkins, Shorty Mac's brother, a PE teacher at the Smithville High School. In Smithville, DJ Screw is a hero. He pulled a lot of people up from the streets and into the rap game. So when he died, they lost both a friend and a CEO.
Damn, we gon' miss you, Screw. I'm just a fan and didn't even know you. Never screwed you, but screwed to you. The SUC screwed up.
For Studio 360, this is Michael May in Austin, Texas.
Banging Screw on a Sunday. It's a beautiful day to slide in leather seats and hit the streets and swing.
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking today with the novelist and physicist Alan Lightman. Alan, what do you make of that?
Well, I thought it was marvelous, and I thought the music sounded totally different being played at half speed or whatever. I have heard rap music at regular speed because my daughter is 15 years old, so I hear a lot of that. But it certainly raised some questions for me. One of them was, why does it seem slow? Well, it seems slow relative to the way that we've heard it before. And then I was thinking, well, if the perception of speed is all relative, then why is it that all people talk at about the same speed? And I wonder whether in all languages and all cultures do people speak at about the same speed? And if that's true, why do we speak at the speed that we do? Do we speak as fast as is possible to still be able to process the information? So these are some kind of questions that this Screw music raised in my mind.
It also raised in my mind the interesting and, once again, ironic fact that with the use of technology, DJ Screw is able to slow things down. That it's almost as if, in your view of life achieving this hyper-accelerated pace, mm-hmm. it is the very tools of technology with which he maybe... You know, if the high water mark of velocity and the kind of extreme experience of time was reached in some measure with kind of aggressive rap music, that now we've turned the corner and we're kind of choosing to go backward.
Yes, he's almost used technology against itself.
Do you think that you talked about the seemingly universal pace of human speech from culture to culture?
Yes.
Do you think that the sense of what's fast and what's slow is also universal from culture to culture?
Well, that's a good question. I do think that the human mind and human psychology is very sensitive to relatives more than absolutes. We do respond to relatives. A light and dark. The eyes' response to light and dark are done on a relative basis. The way that we see colors is done on a relative basis. A blue can appear green if it's next to the right color, and so on. So I would tend to think that there's some hardwire built into the body and to the mind, but I think that a lot of it is just the experience of relatives.
Alan Lightman is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. Our next story is about what time can do to physical things. There's a decaying, abandoned train station on the southwestern edge of downtown Detroit. It's visible for miles around. Every window on the building's 18 floors is broken, and pigeons and crows flutter constantly around the shell. The Michigan Central Station was built in the 19-teens as a big, opulent monument to the future of Detroit. The architectural photographer Robert Polidori and the poet and urban planner Kristen Palm each have a look at what time has done to the station.
People came to Detroit through this building. People left Detroit through this building. People went off to war
through this building. People fell in love in this building. I can't stand in front of it without sort of just kneeling down and getting all misty-eyed. I think it would be an amazing building if it were in good condition, and nobody's interested in buildings here until they're decayed. Then you create your own stories and your own myths about it, and whether people say it or not, you know, I think there's this feeling of ghosts being inside, which you don't feel in a building that's remained in use or a building that's been redeveloped.
I take photos of things that I know are going to be left to die. I had no aesthetic draw to that building per se. It was an ideological attraction. I was living in Paris and I saw a thing on CNN about downtown Detroit. And I said, oh my God, it looked like Beirut that I was photographing at that time. I had no idea that the city of Detroit was that much abandoned. And so I started to do some research as to why that was. Whatever economy fed it died. That's what I found. That's what I feel about Detroit. Like in Beirut, it got killed by war. In Havana, by lack of money and hurricanes. There, it's just by an economy just left.
You know, you walk in and it's cavernous. These rooms are gigantic, designed so that when you walked in, there was this sense of grandeur. You know, you're arriving or you're traveling, and, you know, the sense of grandeur is obviously gone, and so it leaves this sense of space. It's easy for me to, you know, to admire this and walk around and find it fascinating. I wasn't born here. I don't have to attend the Detroit Public Schools. I don't have limited options because I live here. I can leave whenever I want. And so for a lot of people, I think, you know, this symbolizes what they can't leave and how the city has sort of not worked out for them. But people used the building, people lived in the building. People came and took photographs. There have been art shows here, raves. People have, you know, gone off up to the roof for the view and to see fireworks.
I say I like to shoot habitat, and by that I mean it's the way that people or society transforms architecture. I'm looking for traces of what has transpired at different epochs or different eras, different years. It's like layering. I see like history is always layered one on top of another, and when they restore, then they take away a layer and put a new one on top of it. So I'm looking for traces.
There's a sociologist and photographer in New York, Camilo Jose Vergara, who has this, you know, somewhat notorious theory that part of Detroit should be roped off and become an urban ruins park. That doesn't sit so well with me either. I mean, that's like a Disneyfication of what we have here. And so many photographers and artists and others have gotten a lot of mileage out of coming to Detroit, you know, talking about what they envision here and how we might creatively deal with this crisis. And the New York Times eats that crap up, you know, and they're not so interested in what the people who are living here have to say about it. You know, realistically, I guess it would have to be redeveloped or torn down. In my dream world, we would just leave it alone and start thinking about cities differently and start thinking about them more like we think about nature, like things that progress. I mean, this building symbolizes that time passes and that uses change and people change, and there is not a need for this building anymore. Detroit cannot sustain this building anymore. And that's not necessarily the tragedy that people make it out to be. I mean, it's just the way it is.
Do you really want to know what I think will happen to it? I think it will be demolished. Because I think that there's nothing that, there's no economy that warrants it.
The wonderful photographer Robert Polidori and the poet Kristen Palm collaborated on a portrait of the Detroit train station for Metropolis magazine. You can see pictures on our website, studio360.org. Michigan Radio's Tamar Charney produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the physicist and author Alan Lightman. Alan, does that story, which I found very beautiful and interesting, does that story connect with your notion of the acceleration of our capitalist culture, this thing that in, I don't know, 70 years went from being a brand new temple to a ruin?
Well, I think it connects more just to the impermanence of all human-made artifacts and constructions, that we know that everything in nature is impermanent, but I think that there's something particularly poignant and disturbing about the impermanence of human-made constructions like buildings. They sort of represent our attempt to circumvent the natural course of our individual lives and have some kind of immortality. And even though we know that's impossible, we struggle against that fate anyway. I think of Ode to a Grecian Urn, and I think of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, where the poet says over and over again that human beings have tried to build cities that would last for thousands of years, and the cities eventually crumble and turn to dust, just like human bones. But I still think there's something beautiful about ruins, something almost sacred about ruins of buildings, that they represent our attempt to struggle against our mortal fate. And I don't think that old buildings should be totally destroyed. I think there should be something left of them to show that attempt. It's part of our history, and that's what connects one generation of human beings to the next, and gives some meaning to the individual deaths of individual people, that somehow through history that we're part of a long chain of human beings who have lived and are somehow part of one thing, one living thing.
Are there physical spaces and places in the world, in Cambridge, in the universe, that you use as markers of time, a time in your life, or that you so closely associate with some moment that they become intertwined with time in a way?
Yes, that's a wonderful thought. There's a place in Ithaca, New York, Cayuga Lake, where I fell in love with my wife. And I do go back there occasionally and see how that place has changed. A dock that goes out about 50 feet into the lake there. And the dock has weathered. The wood has changed color. It's chipped away. And I do walk back to that place once in a while to remember that time in the past.
Alan Lightman is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. Coming up, we'll talk about how movie makers mess with time. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest is Alan Lightman, the author of Einstein's Dreams, among other books. We're talking about time. Whenever we enter a movie theater, our sense of time is almost sure to be manipulated. One cut can jump decades. Bullets sometimes stop and linger on screen like drips of water. But what can those leaps in cinematic time reveal about our own real day-to-day experience? We asked three film critics to dissect how some filmmakers have played with time in their recent movies.
When we were studying film theory, there was a famous essay we read by this guy Stephen Heath, who's a well-known film theorist, and the quote at the beginning was something like, "It is precise to say that events take place." But I think it's more precise to say that events take time.
You know, Hitchcock said there were movies, but life with the dull bits cut out.
The way that time moves is often through narrative. When you think about your life, for example, you narrativize it. You see it as a story. It started back there in the past, and then it moves through a series of events that we tell as stories. And that's exactly what cinema does.
Time is conventionalized. We know when a flashback is happening. We know that we have skipped certain events, and we go into this fictional time zone.
One of the first things a filmmaker learns or realizes is that he's dealing with time.
You really need a system if you're going to make it work. You kind of learn to trust your own handwriting.
I think one of the things that's interesting about Christopher Nolan's Memento is the fact that it plays with the notion of amnesia.
No!
We begin with a character committing an assault on someone. We don't know why.
Well, that's the thing. I have this condition.
A condition?
It's my memory.
Amnesia?
No. It's different from that. I have no short-term memory.
And then the scenes unfurl in reverse time. At the end of each successive scene, he gives you the beginning of the previous scene. So we're just as hamstrung in a way as Guy Pearce is.
Film noir traditionally is about a main male character who is disoriented.
No one is trustworthy.
Memento is a sort of contemporary version of noir, and it pushes that to an extreme.
He's sort of subject to the manipulation of the people around him, and I think that's a perfect example of what critics fear is happening to us as a culture, that we're becoming people who are easily manipulated by the media around us because we don't have long-term memory. We don't have a sense of history. Everything is always about the present and the immediate.
Run, Lola, Run, which Tom Tickford made and released in 1999, tells the same story three different times.
So here, Lola is running to try and stop Manny before he goes into the market to try and hold it up. And
we actually have a split screen here with Lola running with the bag that's going to save her boyfriend.
Manny! He hears her and turns, and now the split screen has dissolved. He's putting his gun away.
You can feel the tension is rising, not only from the music, but from their imminent meeting. And oh, a big red truck came between Lola and Manny and took Manny out.
What the director does is stop the story after the first sequence and, in a sense, roll back and let her do the task again with a different outcome.
We see here the story starting again with the phone dropping onto the hook, and she runs out of the room. And
it's almost as if her desire to have the event happen differently transforms the event, and it's almost as if our desire to have her succeed transforms the event as well.
To me, it felt like a video game. You get killed fighting the aliens, well, you just start the game from scratch again.
She becomes a cartoon at a certain point, and cartoon characters, we know, they die, and then they get up, and they start going again.
Even though she's not conscious that she's doing it again, there's, I think, as viewers, the desire to be able to go back and replay, to do it right, to make changes. But I also think that it again plays into ideas that are very culturally present, such as sampling and the loop, and this interest in sort of redoing and remaking, recycling images and sequences, and the sense that no repetition is ever pure. Each repetition is always slightly different. There's never the pure repetition because it's always in a different place in time. Something has happened.
You know, Hitchcock said there were movies, but life with the dull bits cut out. In Time Code, Mike Figgis is leaving everything in.
And
the bottom left corner, there's a clock.
In Time Code, Mike Figgis takes a single story and follows four paths of that story in real time with four different cameras.
Four images.
Two women who are riding in a car, riding in a cab. One of them's reading a newspaper.
He takes his film frame and divides it into four parts and shows each of the strands of the story that are told through each of the four camera crews. And he directs our attention through the sound mix.
What you're hearing is an earthquake in Los Angeles.
Now it looks like the earthquake is happening, and all four different...
We had some nice shaky cam there.
...character scenarios are responding to the earthquake.
Right, they're all experiencing the earthquake simultaneously.
As people, we understand our stories to be sort of linear and kind of unique. But right next to my story is your story. Next to your story is someone else's story. And your story is intersecting with all of these other stories. So there's a sense that there's no way, one, that time can be linear, and two, that we should even understand time in that way, because that's not how it works.
Rashomon seems like a strong historical precedent for this kind of film.
Time Code is saying that there are multiple times. Similarly, I think when we look at the news or when we're online and we have multiple windows open on our computer, there's a sense that all of this stuff is happening simultaneously. And if you think about it, Mike Figgis' film Time Code has a similar sense of windows on a computer screen. It's almost a desktop aesthetic or something where, you know, you're seeing these multiple things and everything. We're doing all of these things at the same time. I don't know, it's almost as though we're beginning to embody these kind of multiple simultaneities in how we're functioning in our everyday lives.
This element of chronology and of the film taking time in our lives and taking up time is more invisible than invisible editing or invisible composition that draws us into the fiction. When we were studying film theory, there was a famous essay we read by this guy Stephen Heath, who's a well-known film theorist, and the quote at the beginning was something like, "It is precise to say that events take place." But I think it's more precise to say that events take time.
We heard from David Lederman, a film critic at the College of San Mateo, Holly Willis, the editor of Res magazine, and Michael Fox, a film critic for the San Francisco Weekly. Our piece was produced by Jonathan Mitchell. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking today with the writer and physicist Alan Lightman about time. Alan, do you enjoy those kinds of films?
Well, I've actually seen Memento and Run, Lola, Run, and I enjoyed them very much. I thought that they were extremely imaginative and did make us question how we experience time and experience events. The Time Code, I'm not familiar with, but I think it would be distracting to me to see a screen split into several pieces at once. But I think there is a cultural trend to multitask. For example, talking on a cell phone while you're walking through a park. You know, where is your body? Where is your mind?
Or hearing somebody tapping away at their email as you're on the phone with them. That's one of those symptoms of the modern time malaise, I think.
Oh yes. Whereas I think that Memento and Run, Lola, Run were doing something different from that. I don't think that those were about necessarily the simultaneity of events at once, but more about the different ways that time can be experienced. The multiple universes in Run, Lola, Run I like very much, and it has a resonance with the idea in quantum physics that there are several different realities that coexist simultaneously. One can interpret each of the replays of the story as being a different universe that was somehow there at the same time that all of them were possible. And I think that from a human level, this is appealing because we often regret choices that we make that we think have major life consequences, don't we? And wonder what if I had called up this woman and spoken to her instead of never returned her call? How would my life have been different? And it's kind of appealing in a sense to think that there's a universe in which you did return her call.
Our next story is about a group of artists and designers who are trying to teach our culture to think ahead, way ahead, by using a single massive clock. The Long Now Foundation is designing a clock to tell time over the next 10,000 years. Studio 360's Lital Molad spoke with the director of the project, designer Alexander Rose.
Look at a clock or check your watch. Does it make you feel anxious, like time is running out? Now imagine a clock that doesn't make you rush, that slows you down. One that makes you feel that time will last forever.
What it hopes to be is an experience similar to what one might get at the edge of the Grand Canyon or looking at a telescope into space, where you all of a sudden get a sense of very, very deep time.
Alexander Rose is the director of the Long Now Foundation. Long Now scientists, designers, and artists believe that humans need to think more long-term.
We do research into making things slower and better instead of faster and cheaper. We actually take our time and don't go with the very first solution that works, but actually find several solutions that work until we find the one that works on many levels, both aesthetically and visually and as an engineering problem.
The clock of the Long Now will tick once a year, bong once a century, and play music once a millennium. The clock will be 60 feet high and built in the limestone cliffs of the Great Basin Natural Forest in Nevada. That's the site of the oldest living trees on Earth. How do you build a precise clock that will last 10,000 years?
Most clocks do their calculations with gear work, whereas this clock does it with binary mechanics, which uses levers going back and forth to represent ones and zeros. So it's as accurate as an electronic digital system, but as simple and as easy to understand as a mechanical system. The interesting thing is as we increasingly make the prototypes larger, we're using lower and lower technology, and eventually when we build the final clock, we'll basically be using the very first metal working technologies there were, things like sand casting, because it's in fact the only way to make things that large out of metal. And so this clock eventually will be made with kind of Bronze Age technology. Everything we do to perfection. We don't stop when it's just made. We have to make it beautiful and right.
The black concave face of the clock has no hands. Instead, it shows the patterns of the stars in the night sky. Around it, concentric metal rings mark the years. Below is the gearwork, stacks of rotating metal discs. Two gold-colored screws tower along the sides of the clock, the spiral drives that make the clock tick.
The drives are weight drives. They require humans to wind them, which was a purposeful thing, is to get human involvement there. And in fact, with the new second prototype of the clock, when you approach it, is telling the wrong time. It's telling the time of the last person who visited it. And the clock is keeping time, but the dials don't show the correct time, and you have to wind it, and it winds it up to the now point. And so you actually, the human is the last piece of clockwork in the clock.
The real challenge is to build something simple enough for hundreds of generations to maintain. But humans have thought this way before. Rose often talks about the hall at New College, Oxford, built in 1386. The original architects anticipated having to replace the oak beams in the ceiling. So they planted a grove of oak trees nearby, which were used 5 centuries later to repair the building.
That kind of myth-building thing is ultimately what we're after. We want this clock to be a story that people tell other people about. These crazy people out here in California are doing a 10,000-year project. Why don't we be conservative and do a 1,000-year project? A kind of mechanism for people to prove that there are long-term projects, and people do them.
For Studio 360, I'm Lital Molad.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and our subject today is time. I'm talking to the author and physicist, Alan Lightman. Alan, does that idea appeal to you as much as it appeals to me?
Oh, I love the idea of the clock that chimes once a year and sings, plays a song once a millennium. As an astrophysicist, it brings to mind looking at faraway galaxies that are actually in collision with each other. And I think a few days ago there were some pictures published from the Hubble Space Telescope that showed a picture of two galaxies colliding with each other And you look in your telescope and you see these two galaxies that look so small, and they have their tails flaring like comets. And you realize that it's going to take 100 million years for them to collide. And that's real slow motion in nature. And yet we can see all these things with our telescopes.
When one thinks of time at that scale, it begins to make all of human existence begin to seem like a rounding error in the great span of time.
Yes, it does. But what is so amazing to me is that the human mind is able to contemplate these things, that on this tiny speck of our planet, which is just a speck of dust in the cosmos, our whole planet, and we are ants on that speck, micro specks, that we are able to contemplate these vast stretches of time and space that go far, far beyond our own puny lifetimes and far, far beyond this tiny speck of Earth that we live on, and we're able to contemplate these vast stretches of time and space and to make sense of them and even to measure them. And that blows my mind.
Alan Lightman, I want to thank you very much for joining me today in Studio 360.
It was a pleasure being on your show, Kurt.
Alan Lightman's latest novel is called The Diagnosis, and it's in paperback now. For more information about his work and about any of the stories you've heard on our program today, visit our website, studio360.org. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Mulad,
Rob Weisberg,
Andy Lancet,
Sarah Lilly,
Michael Rayfield.
The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Tiffany & Company Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
Blue eyes looking through an old gray curtain.
I was a songwriter who nobody liked my songs.
The unplanned success of songwriter Lee Hazlewood.
I think that he should be widely known and hailed as, you know, next to Burt Bacharach and great American songwriters such as that.
Defining artistic success. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.